The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Today, we're tackling a really significant, challenging, but I think essential work, Isabel Wilkerson's Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents. This book, it really offers a new way, a new lens to look at some of America's oldest, most stubborn problems.
It really does. And it forces you to confront a tough question, right? Why is it that decades, literally decades after the Civil Rights Movement, we still see such deep systemic inequality in the U.S.? Wilkerson's answer is, well, it's provocative. It really demands we reframe the whole conversation.
And that's exactly what we want to get into in this deep dive, understanding that reframing. We're so used to talking about race, but Wilkerson argues that race is, you know, maybe just the symptom, the visible part.
Exactly. She says the real issue, the underlying structure, is this invisible framework she calls caste.
That distinction feels critical because it shifts the focus from, say, individual bad actors or isolated incidents of prejudice
towards the actual architecture, this deep inherited social structure that dictates everything. Your standing, your access to resources, respect, opportunities, it's all laid out.
So if we miss that architecture, we're kind of missing the root cause of why these problems persist.
Precisely. We're just treating the symptoms, not the disease itself.
Okay, so let's talk about the person who developed this concept for us, Isabel Wilkerson. She's not just any writer. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a historian.
Oh, absolutely a force. Made history back in 1994, first Black woman to win a Pulitzer Prize for individual reporting. Her perspective is just so unique because it blends decades of really meticulous historical deep dives with sharp journalistic insight and a powerful narrative voice.
And Cast, this book, it didn't just come out of nowhere, right? It grew out of the research for her previous huge work, The Warmth of Other Suns.
That's right. The Warmth of Other Suns chronicled the Great Migration, the movement of 6 million Black Americans out of the Jim Crow South.
An absolutely epic story.
It is. And while she was deep in those stories, interviewing people, digging through archives, she started to realize something. The forces these people were fleeing.
Mm.
It wasn't just random hatred or, you know, unfair laws. It felt like something more systematic.
More rigid.
Exactly. More fixed, more absolute than just racism as we typically think about it. It was like a system designed for permanent control, a hierarchy you couldn't escape just by, say, moving north.
Wow. So the logic of the system followed them.
It did. And that realization pushed her to look broader, to compare the American racial hierarchy with other fixed systems around the world. She synthesizes just vast amounts of information, history, sociology, personal stories into this really compelling narrative. She's giving us a new vocabulary, really.
Let's dive into that vocabulary then. She starts with a central metaphor that I think is really helpful. America as an old house.
Yeah, the old house we've all inherited. You know, we didn't build it. We didn't choose the materials. Maybe you didn't even know about the cracks in the foundation.
But we live here now. And we're responsible for the upkeep, for fixing those structural flaws.
And caste, she argues, is that flawed foundation.
Hmm.
Her core thesis is basically that the racial hierarchy we see in the U.S. isn't just about race. It's a deeply embedded, rigid caste system, an artificial ranking of human value.
Okay, artificial ranking, that feels key. And this ranking dictates who gets respect, who gets resources, who's seen as, well, inherently valuable.
Right, it shapes everything. Often invisibly.
So let's really nail down this difference she makes between caste and race. We said race is the visible part, the skin.
Yeah, race is the visible signifier that American society seized upon to sort people. It's a uniform, you could say. But caste is the underlying power structure. It's the bones.
The bones. I like that.
It's the rigid hierarchy itself. Race is just the tool used in the U.S. to assign people their place within that hierarchy. In other places, different tools might be used, religion, lineage, whatever. But the underlying structure, the caste logic, functions in a disturbingly similar way.
Which brings us to the global comparisons. She looks closely at the U.S. system alongside India's ancient hierarchy, particularly the oppression of Dalits, and also Nazi Germany's racial hierarchy.
Yeah.
Why those three specifically?
Well, it's powerful because it shows this isn't some uniquely American pathology. It's a human pattern, unfortunately. By comparing the U.S., India, and Nazi Germany, she reveals the universal playbook for creating and maintaining these kinds of divisions.
Oh, playbook.
Yeah, the mechanisms used to enforce the ranking, what she calls the pillars of caste, they show up again and again across cultures, across time. It demonstrates the underlying logic isn't tied to one specific group or place.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's unpack some related terms we often mix up. Caste, race, and class. We usually think of class as something you can change, right? There's mobility.
That's the crucial difference, yeah. Class is typically based on socioeconomic factors. Mm-hmm. Wealth, education, occupation, and theoretically, at least, you can move up or down the class ladder. It's not easy, but it's possible.
You could win the lottery or get a degree, start a business.
Right. But caste. Wilkerson argues caste is fixed. It's inherited. It doesn't matter how talented you are, how wealthy you become, how educated you are. Your position in the caste hierarchy is assigned at birth and is incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to change within the existing system. It's baked in.
Wow. And she uses this amazing story about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. visiting India in 1959 to illustrate just how universal this logic is.
Yes, that story is, it's really foundational to her argument. Dr. King was visiting a school attended by Dalits, the group formerly known as Untouchables, in India's caste system.
Okay.
And the principal introduced him to these students, not just as an American civil rights leader, but as, get this, a fellow Untouchable from the United States.
Whoa. Oh, how did King react?
He was apparently stunned at first, but then deeply moved. He recognized immediately that the systemic oppression he was fighting against in the American South, it had this clear parallel halfway across the world. Different skin, same bones.
That's incredibly powerful. It shows the underlying system operates on the same fundamental logic, regardless of the specific groups involved.
Exactly. And that shared logic is what Wilkerson breaks down into what she calls the eight pillars of caste. These are the tools, the mechanisms consistently used to build and maintain these hierarchies.
The building blocks of the system. And these pillars, you see them across the U.S., India, and Nazi Germany.
You do, with variations, of course, but the core function is the same. Let's touch on a few of the most critical ones. She argues the most crucial pillar for maintaining the hierarchy's purity is
endogamy, control of marriage.
Precisely. Endogamy and the control of marriage and mating. The dominant caste must restrict intimate relationships, marriage, and reproduction across caste lines. Why? To maintain the supposed purity of their lineage and prevent blurring the lines.
We saw that very clearly with anti-miscegenation laws in the U.S., right? Which were only struck down by the Supreme Court in 1967, Loving v. Virginia.
Exactly. And in Nazi Germany, this was brutally enforced through the Nuremberg laws. It's about controlling bloodlines to maintain the hierarchy.
And even though those laws are gone in the U.S., you could argue the social pressure against mixing, the way neighborhoods are often segregated, it still serves a similar function, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The enforcement might shift from legal to social or economic, but the impulse to maintain separation is still there, which connects directly to another pillar, purity versus pollution.
Ah, the idea that the dominant group is inherently clean, pure, virtuous.
And the subordinate group is seen as inherently dirty, contaminated, polluting, maybe even dangerous.
We saw that literally with segregated pools, water fountains, even Bibles used in courtrooms.
Yes, and today.
Yeah.
Think about where toxic waste dumps or polluting industries are often located. Look at disparities in environmental quality between neighborhoods. It's often a modern manifestation of that same purity pollution logic, treating certain groups as if their presence contaminates the environment, justifying neglect or exposure to harm.
So it becomes an ideological justification for physical separation and unequal living conditions.
It really does. And if anyone dares to challenge these boundaries, physical, social, relational balone, the system often responds with another pillar, terror as enforcement.
This sounds like the violence used to keep people in their place.
It is. Systematic violence, or the threat of violence, used to uphold the boundaries and punish anyone who steps out of line, especially those from the subordinate caste. Lynchings in the Jim Crow South were horrific public rituals of enforcement designed to terrorize the entire community.
And how might we see that pillar operating today, perhaps more subtly?
Well, we have to analyze things like disparities in policing, sentencing, mass incarceration through this lens. Is the system disproportionately applying force or punishment to maintain social control over certain groups? It's about ensuring the subordinate caste remembers its place through fear.
And all of this, the separation, the pollution fears, the violence, it's only possible because of the psychological underpinning, right? Dehumanization and stigma.
Exactly. You can't systematically oppress a group if you see them as fully human, just like you. So the dominant caste has to create and perpetuate narratives that portray the subordinate caste as less intelligent, less capable, more prone to criminality. Less human, essentially.
Like propaganda?
It functions like propaganda. It justifies the cruelty. It allows the dominant group to enforce the system, often brutally, while maintaining a sense of their own innocence or righteousness. It strips the subordinate group of empathy in the eyes of the dominant one.
It's chilling, and Wilkerson really emphasizes how this caste system isn't just about laws or overt violence. It operates in subtle ways, everyday interactions, these unwritten rules and cues.
Yeah, she calls it the wordless usher in a darkened theater, quietly guiding everyone to their assigned seats without anyone consciously thinking about it. It's in the assumptions people make, the microaggressions, the way space is navigated.
The constant low-level stress of knowing you might be judged or suspected based on your perceived caste.
Absolutely. And that constant navigation, that stereotype threat she discusses, it takes a real measurable toll psychologically and physically. It contributes directly to the quantifiable disparities we see in health outcomes, wealth accumulation, even life expectancy between dominant and subordinate groups.
But here's where Wilkerson adds another layer that I found really compelling. She insists the system actually harms the dominant caste, too. It's not just morally wrong, it's damaging to them as well.
Yes, this idea of a spiritual and moral rot. Maintaining the hierarchy requires a degree of denial, doesn't it? You have to ignore evidence, suppress empathy, believe in your own inherent superiority despite, well, reality.
It sounds exhausting, frankly.
It likely creates deep-seated anxiety about losing that unearned status. And that constant need to justify the hierarchy, to dehumanize others, it erodes empathy. It leads to what she calls a moral calcification. You could link this to broader social issues, perhaps even things like the deaths of despair we see affecting some parts of the dominant group.
So, the system ends up trapping everyone in different ways. Let's crystallize some key takeaways for listeners. First, this idea of the invisibility and pervasiveness.
Right. American caste works most effectively when it's unnamed and unacknowledged. It hides in plain sight, often using coded language talking about urban problems or welfare dependency, instead of explicitly naming the hierarchical structures at play.
It allows the system to persist without anyone having to consciously defend caste.
Exactly. The second big takeaway is the sheer economic irrationality of it all.
This one seems counterintuitive. Don't dominant groups benefit economically?
They might gain relatively within the system, but Wilkerson argues the system as a whole makes the entire society poorer. Think about it. You're artificially limiting the potential, the talent, the contributions of a huge segment of your population based on an arbitrary birth characteristic.
You're leaving talent on the table, wasting human capital.
Precisely. It reduces overall innovation, productivity, efficiency. It's ultimately a drag on the entire economy, even for those who seem to benefit in the short term. It's fundamentally self-defeating for the society.
Okay. And the third key theme, which feels incredibly relevant right now, is the system's fierce self-preservation, what she calls backlash.
Yes. This explains so much about American history. Whenever there's a period of progress towards greater equality, towards challenging the caste structure,
there's a reaction, often a fierce one.
A fierce, often violent backlash aims squarely at restoring the traditional hierarchy. Think about the end of Reconstruction. It was followed immediately by the rise of Jim Crow laws and intense violence to put Black Americans back in their place.
Or, she suggests, more recent political reactions following periods of perceived progress, like the election of Barack Obama.
Exactly. It helps explain why progress often feels like two steps forward, one and a half steps back. It's not a smooth, linear path because the system itself actively fights against being dismantled. Any perceived loss of status by the dominant caste triggers this defensive reaction.
It's like the old house resisting repairs.
That's a great way to put it. And Wilkerson's writing itself is just full of these powerful, memorable phrases that really capture these ideas.
Yeah, her language is incredible. The central one we keep coming back to has to be caste is the bones, race is the skin. It just clicks, doesn't it? It unlocks the whole structural idea.
It really does. And she has this direct challenge to denial, too. For anyone who wants to argue about the reality of systemic inequality, she basically says, you don't have to have an opinion on a fact. You might as well have an opinion on the sun.
Love that. Facts are facts.
Right. And she doesn't shy away from the cost of maintaining the system, especially for those who benefit. She writes, the price of privilege is the moral calcification of the souls of those who benefit from it.
Oof, that hits hard. It suggests that willful ignorance isn't just passive, it's actively corrosive to one's own humanity.
It really does. But she also shows that resistance is possible, even within an overwhelming system. She tells the story of August Landmesser.
The man in the famous photograph from Nazi Germany.
That's the one. The lone German worker in a crowd, arms folded, refusing to give the Nazi salute in 1936.
Such a powerful image.
He stands as this symbol of individual conscience, right? Someone who, despite immense pressure from the dominant caste he belonged to, refused to participate in the collective performance of the hierarchy. He chose not to be complicit.
That choice, that individual refusal, it feels like a bridge to how we might apply this framework in our own lives.
Yeah.
Wilkerson's main suggestion is practicing radical empathy.
Yes, and radical is the key word there. It's not just feeling sorry for someone. It's a conscious, active, sustained effort to truly see across those caste lines.
How do you practice that?
It means actively choosing to believe another person's account of their lived experience, especially when it's completely different from your own, maybe even uncomfortable or challenging to your worldview. It's about dismantling the psychological walls, the dehumanization, the stigma that the caste system relies on. It's daily work.
Okay, that makes sense on a personal level. What about professionally? How can this lens help in, say, the workplace?
Well, think about the pillar of occupational hierarchy, the idea that caste often pre-sorts people into expected roles, if you're serious about things like meritocracy.
You have to look for those hidden caste dynamics.
Exactly. Ask. Are certain groups consistently met with more skepticism during hiring or promotion? Are leadership roles dominated by one group? Are there unwritten rules about who fits in that might be acting as caste filters, regardless of actual talent or skill?
It pushes you to look beyond stated ideals of fairness and examine the actual pattern.
Right. And then socially? Politically. The concept of backlash is incredibly useful for decoding what's happening around us. If you see intense, seemingly disproportionate opposition to policies aimed at increasing equality opposition that doesn't quite make sense on purely economic or logical grounds, analyze it through the caste lens.
You might see it's rooted in that fear of losing status.
Often, yeah. It reveals the defense mechanism kicking in, that deep, often unconscious anxiety about a perceived loss of standing within the hierarchy. It helps make sense of seemingly irrational political polarization.
You know, reflecting on all this, the thing that struck me most is realizing how deeply this inherited architecture, as she calls it, is embedded. It's not just laws. It's in our culture, our language, our unconscious biases.
It is deep.
But understanding it as inherited feels weirdly liberating. It shifts the conversation away from just blaming individuals today and towards a collective responsibility for addressing this flawed system we occupy. We didn't build it, but we have to deal with it.
And that, I think, leads to the final provocative thought we want to leave you with. Wilkerson makes it clear that this system, this caste hierarchy, it ultimately imprisons everyone. It demands a denial of our shared humanity, trapping people in rigid roles.
Both dominant and subordinate castes pay a price.
Absolutely. But here's the crucial part. Because caste is a human construct, it's artificial, it was built. It can also be dismantled by human action. It's not inevitable. It's not nature.
So the first step is seeing it clearly.
Yes. That collective awakening, recognizing the flawed house we live in and taking responsibility for its repair, that's the essential starting point. Wilkerson's work gives us the blueprint, the vocabulary, the x-ray vision we need for that recognition.
It truly feels like an essential diagnosis for understanding America and maybe even human societies more broadly, a necessary foundation for any real progress or healing. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.